And now, Robert Trout on the news. From the NBC Convention Headquarters in Philadelphia, presented by Pillsbury. Lady, here are four ways to touch a man's heart. Serve him homemade strawberry, gooseberry, raspberry, blueberry pies made with Pillsbury pie crust mix. Your pie crust will be tender, flaky, and rich with delicious flavor. Use Pillsbury pie crust mix. It's quick, it's easy, it's already blended in one convenient package. You just add water. There's 9 full ounces in each package, ample makings for a big, rich flavored, delicious two-crust pie. Get Pillsbury pie crust mix tomorrow. And now, Bob Trout in Philadelphia with the latest news.
I'm speaking from the NBC booth, looking down on Philadelphia's convention hall, where we've been watching the first real open controversy in the new Progressive Party. It came during this debate on the platform and crystallized in an amendment that would have implied criticism of Moscow's foreign policy as well as American foreign policy. But after about 15 minutes of debate, these delegates roared the amendment down with a resounding no. So the Progressive Party platform stands pretty much as it was first drafted, advocating limited nationalization of industry and ultra-strong civil rights domestically. On foreign policy, repeal of the draft, the Marshall Plan, and the Truman Doctrine. And now the debate seems to be almost ended, though there's still a lot of activity down there on the floor on the other side of this plate glass window in front of our booth. Well, the Wallace platform will be carried to the special session of Congress by Vito Marcantonio, New York's Labor Party representative and a leader in this progressive party. But it's the older parties that will probably provide the fireworks at the special session. The rebel Dixiecrats have called a filibuster strategy conference for tomorrow or Tuesday when they hope to perfect a plan involving amending the journal, which is not subject to the Senate cloture or gag rule, so the senators can talk a long, long time that way. The other big opposition group, the Republicans, now say only a flat endorsement by New York's Governor Tom Dewey could push through a new housing bill. Nothing else would do it. But regardless of what happens on the floor of Congress, one thing is sure, official travel expense accounts for the special session are going to cost the taxpayers nearly $250,000. In between sessions for their expense accounts, the touring congressmen have been hearing about Berlin. We don't know exactly what General Clay told them, but we do know he charged the Capitol air with hope. The members of Congress who talked to General Clay during his visit now are convinced the present firm policy in Berlin will ease the crisis. They've been assured Russia is not building up attack forces. The top drawer American conference on the new Firmness for Peace program was moved from London. General Clay went on to Berlin, and United States Ambassador Douglas joined him there today, and then so did the American ambassador to Moscow. They met in the midst of late reports of growing political unrest in the Soviet occupation zone itself, where the Russians now say they've sentenced more than 20 German terrorists. 16 fully armed American jet fighter planes have roared into Germany after a 5,000-mile, 12-hour flight from Michigan. Tragedy in the air, too. 26 vacationing lumberjacks and a crew of 2 have died in a Canadian DC-3 crack-up. But also, Progress, the world's largest commercial-type airplane with a capacity of 180 passengers, is now making its first transcontinental flight. The new French Premier, André Marie, says he's ironed out his differences with the French opposition and will complete his cabinet tonight or tomorrow. Washington reports American life expectancy now exceeds the biblical 70 for the first time. For the ladies, at least, we men can expect 65 years of life, but 70 for the females. No doubt about it, you women usually have the last word. And now for a last word for Pillsbury, here's Arthur Gary.
Thank you, Bob Trout. There's a good reason why Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix is the largest selling pie crust mix in America. The reason why is in the pie. Yes, the pie you bake with Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix has a tempting golden brown color, tender, flaky crust that cuts at the touch of a fork, and the rich flavor of fine shortening. It's easy to fix, it's fast, it's convenient, it's sure. Sure to make perfect pie. Get a package of America's largest seller, Pillsbury Pie Crust Mix, and bake your family homemade pie soon. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Ready!
I, the undersigned, declare on my honor that I am an amateur, according to the rules of the International Federation governing my sport.
On your mark!
that I have participated in sports solely for pleasure and for physical, mental, or social benefits I derive therefrom.
Get set!
That sport to me is nothing more than a recreation without material gain of any kind, direct or indirect, and that I am eligible in all respects for participation in the Olympic Games.
Living 1948, brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, holds up its radio mirror this opening week of the Olympic Games in London to reflect the saga and the pros and cons of this quadrennial international sport fest in a drama document entitled Box Score on the Olympics. To help tell you all about it, here, pinch-hitting for Ben Grauer, is that good sport, Nelson Case.
Greetings, sports. Well, here we are again. Every 4 years, it has been said, international sport joins international politics to go stark raving mad. However that may be, this is the week, after a war-necessitated hiatus of 12 years, when His Majesty King George VI of England, this time cast in the role of patron of the sports, declares...
I... proclaim open the Olympic Games of London, celebrating the 14th Olympiad of the modern era.
There is a fanfare of trumpets, followed by a ceremonial release of doves, symbolizing peace. But alas, there will probably be little peace. For the return of the Olympics revives not only an ancient contest of skill, but is the signal for the revival of a popular contest of words, which goes something like this.
The Olympic Games are an invaluable source for the strengthening of international goodwill.
The Olympics, that international rat race, has been about as productive of goodwill among men as the atom bomb.
That clam bake coming up at London has already been marked by enough name-calling to indicate that the Olympic ideal simply does not work in practice.
However it may be, America, to over 50 nations on all the continents of the world, from minute Liechtenstein to giant-size USA, has gone this message from His Majesty's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, the Right Honorable Ernest Bevin, PCMP.
We in Britain are delighted and honored to be the hosts of the first post-war Olympic Games. I extend a very sincere welcome.
But to many Britons, Mr. Bevin speaks only for himself. Editorializes the London Evening Standard.
Even in normal times, British enthusiasm for the Games ranges from lukewarm to loathing. The larder is bare. Yet we are going to give this colossal beano with all the facet effrontery of poor relations trying to show hospitality to distant cousins who have the money.
Yes, well might Britishers with long memories call the Olympics a colossal beano when they look back at the games that were held there in 1908. For a moment, let's look back 40 years.
Absolutely not. The United States is not going to march until you do something about that insult.
But, gentlemen, I assure you it was purely an oversight.
You're listening to the United States representatives threatening to withdraw from the 1908 Games because the American flag is not flying with the colors of the other nations. Now, listen to the Finns.
Ask to carry the Russian flag.
The Finns are protesting carrying the Russian flag in the opening parade in 1908 instead of their own. Somehow, these matters get straightened out and the games proceed, but mostly along this line. In connection with the bicycle races, the French shout,
"We was robbed!"
The angry Swedes withdraw their wrestling team from the Greco-Roman competition because...
the British are giving unfair decision.
And the Americans pull out of the tug-of-war contest.
We won't play. Look at the size of the boots on those Liverpool policemen. Do you expect us to pull them and their shoes, too?
But all of these electric storms fade into summer showers compared to what happens when the 1908 marathon is run. You're seated expectantly in the stadium, waiting for the runners to enter the home stretch. Word has been passed along that of the 75 starters, only an Australian remains. Imagine your astonishment when into the stadium staggers not the Australian, but...
It is Pietri, the Italian!
The diminutive Italian candy maker, dressed in red knickers, is a picture of exhaustion. Tottering, he turns the wrong way as he comes in, and then collapses.
He's there! He's done it!
The British officials rush to the runner, uncertain what to do. But the crowd's not uncertain.
Help him! Vicula!
Turn him about!
This the officials do. Pietri stumbles on, and each time he collapses, he's helped to his feet. Finally, he's literally carried across the finish line, where he collapses in a heap. But suddenly, into the stadium trots an unfaltering runner.
And American!
Virtually unnoticed by most of the crowd still cheering Pietri, the young American runner finishes the race. But the confused British officials declare...
The winner, the Rondo Pietri, of Italy!
Not until later is the United States, too disgusted even to file a protest of this decision, officially awarded the victory.
These were the high spots of the sore spots, America, of the last Olympiad held in Great Britain. Seen in retrospect by sports writer Dan Parker, writing in Sport magazine,
there never has been another Olympic meet to equal the 1908 London affair as a fomenter of international ill will. That it didn't touch off the First World War a half dozen years before it actually exploded is one of the miracles of the first decade of the 20th century.
Today, 40 years later, to a different London, bomb-wounded and ration-hungry, again return the Olympic Games. And how will we, much better off Americans, fare this year? One British newspaper at least offers us its sympathy upon our dilemma.
If well-fed American competitors were to run their ration-hungry opponents into the track, the general reaction would be...
Well, what do you expect? It's not a fair contest.
Equally... An American defeat would be hailed with jeering criticism on the lines of...
Why, they can't even win with all their steaks and butter and cream.
But before we become embroiled in all that, let's go back and see how we got here in the first place. Let's ask and search out the answers to such questions as...
Where did this Olympic business start, anyway?
Who and what makes it tick today?
What's all this about amateurism versus professionalism?
From a sports point of view, as well as an international point of view, are the Olympics a good thing or a bad thing?
Stand by, America, as we Sherlock these questions for you.
And for no bright star more quickening than the sun... Must thou search in the void firmament by day? So neither shall we find any game greater than the Olympic, whereof to utter our voice.
So did the Greek poet Pindar lyricize in his first Olympic ode, the special glory of Olympia over all the other athletic festivals of ancient Greece. Winners were hailed with as much popular enthusiasm as a victor in war. Here are some side notes from a Greek scholar.
When the invaders of Greece were halted at Thermopylae by a handful of persistent defenders, it is said they remarked,
"What manner of men are these who contend in their Olympic games, not for money, but for the sheer glory of achievement?"
When the Rhodian, Diagoras, won the Olympic prize himself and saw his two sons crowned victors the very same day, a Laconian is said to have addressed him thus,
"Die, Diagoras! For thou hast nothing short of divinity to desire."
Not until over 1,000 years had passed were the Olympic Games, damned as corrupt with commercialism, denounced as pagan feasts, suppressed by the Roman Emperor Theodosius as a nuisance.
For almost 1,700 years, America, the ruins of Olympia lay under the debris of time. Until in 1876, archaeologists took up their shovels and unearthed bit by bit the story of the great Olympic Games of Greece. But to only one man did the story suggest anything but historical interest.
My name is Baron Pierre de Coubertin of France. Much impressed by the accent on sports in the schools of England to help train students to meet life as it is, I decided it would be a good idea if the British and French athletes got together and competed. But the difference in the rules, in the very sports themselves, and many other national and political difficulties I found also present, not only here, but in other countries I visited, seemed to conspire against him.
But instead of bringing him discouragement, the idea enlarged itself until soon he was envisioning one world of sport. It was then that he began to think of the Olympics.
Olympia. Here is a symbol superior to cities, to nations, to politics. Why not? Why not? I spoke to everyone, everywhere. At first, I pictured my own country, the scene of the revival. But I was urged to wait upon the Paris exhibition in 1900. I could not bring myself to wait 6 long years. That is how I came to decide to hold the first revival of the Olympic Games in Athens, in the country of their birth.
You may imagine, perhaps, that the idea was greeted by Greece with enthusiasm. No, the attitude of the Greek government can be summed up with one word.
Impossible.
But Coubertin was not easily dissuaded.
We French have a proverb that says the word impossible is not in the French language. I've been told this morning that the word is Greek. I do not believe it.
We Americans, too, have a saying. It's the phrase, by hook or by crook. And it is by hook or by crook that Baron de Coubertin, against the most overwhelming odds and by the sheer pressure of his determination, actually imposed the revival of the ancient Greek games, the first modern Olympiad, upon the people and the government of Greece in 1896.
Attending the first modern Olympiad in Athens in 1896. Your name is Robert Garrett of Princeton. With 4 other American students arriving by cattle boat at Patras and staying up all night on the train, you've reached Athens just in time for the call for the first event. Right now, you're standing in the pit awaiting one of the biggest events of all, the discus throw, the ancient symbol of their games that the Greeks think they have in the bag.
You're a shot putter, Garrett. You've just won that event. You've never in your life seen or thrown a discus. And you ask a Greek official, what's that thing? Well, how do you throw it? Calling an interpreter, he explains... He gives you a few pointers, and you try it a couple of times.
I think I'll enter.
You describe what happened later.
I wanted as much action as I could get, since it meant fun. Never figuring I'd do anything but finish absolute last, I threw the thing.
Mr. Garrett, USA, 95 feet, 7 1/2 inches. You are awarded first place.
No one was more surprised than I was.
Even though none of the Americans had had a chance to train since they left the U.S., they contested in 10 of the 12 events and won 9 championships. Greece was becoming more certain than ever that it should never have revived the games. Then came the marathon, made famous ages ago by Pheidippides, who ran from Marathon to Athens with news of victory.
You hear a roar outside the stadium as the runners approach. Spiridon Luis, a Greek peasant who had spent the night before fasting and praying, crosses the finish line, the winner. The crown prince himself and his brother carry the victor to the royal box on their shoulders, where he is showered with gifts. Yes, now as far as all Greece is concerned, the games are 100% okay.
Thus were the Olympic Games, which we meet again this week, 52 years later, reborn. What kind of organization has kept them going? How do they operate? Listen.
Organization.
Top organization of the Olympic Games is the International Olympic Committee. Governments have nothing to say about the selection of 67 self-supporting members. Reason?
But take us Americans. If we started letting our government select our representatives on the committee, it wouldn't be any time at all before Congress would want to pick the athletes.
Each nation on the committee has...
a National Olympic Committee. Head of the National Olympic Committee in the United States, as any sports writer can tell you...
his name is Brundage. Avery Brundage, a 60-year-old Chicago contractor and hotel executive. He's sports whipping boy and is a target for more vitriolic comment and personal vilification than any other American sports figure. I wouldn't have his job for $1 million.
The time of the Olympic Games.
Every 4 years, dated from 1896.
The place... our object is to see as many different nations as possible
receive a chance to hold the Olympic Games in one of their great cities.
Choice of the city has often led to serious dissension, both domestic and international.
How participants qualify.
Amateurism.
Amateurism is perhaps one of the most controversial subjects that the Olympic Committee must face. The most famous case involving violation of the amateurism rules was that of Jim Thorpe.
Jim Thorpe was an Irish Indian from Oklahoma, one of the greatest athletes the world has ever known. He entered the Olympics of 1912 and won both the pentathlon and the decathlon, scoring the greatest number of points ever scored by an Olympic contender.
The King of Sweden told him,
"You are the world's greatest athlete. I present you with these medals and a bust of myself."
The Tsar of Russia,
"I present you with a silver model of a Viking ship."
Indeed, not only kings, but all the world acclaimed him.
Then some reporter sent the Amateur Athletic Union an article describing Jim's activities with a small pro baseball team in the South. Said Thorpe,
"That's right. I played with the Rocky Mount Club for a few months. Got about $18 a week. I didn't know it affected my amateur status."
Nevertheless,
the medals and bust from the King of Sweden were taken back.
The silver ship model from the Tsar of Russia.
All he won and given to the second in line, a Swedish athlete named Weislander. Far as I know, Weislander never opened the box that contained Thorpe's prizes, but sent them back to the AAU with the comment,
"I didn't win the Olympic championship. James Thorpe did. I do not know what your rules are in regard to amateurism, but I do know that Thorpe is the greatest athlete in the world."
Jim Thorpe, of course, was an all-round athlete, winner both of the pentathlon and decathlon. What are the other events?
Gymnastics, sports of defense, boxing, wrestling, shooting, water sports, riding, cycling, weightlifting, yachting, games from football to pelota, a Spanish-American game played in a court with a ball and wickerwork racket. Winter sports were added in 1924. Women were first allowed to compete in 1912. There are now special programs for the women athletes.
What about the arts?
Little publicized is the somewhat surprising fact that there will be international competition in the arts, organized since 1912, including art, literature, and music, all of which must be inspired by sport.
On the subject of nationalism and the Olympic Games, if Baron de Coubertin, their reviver, were alive today, he'd probably say,
"I never intended that any nation should win the Olympic Games, or any team for that matter. My whole desire was to see the glorification of the individual athlete."
But today, newspapers of all countries have devised their own system for keeping score by nations. Another thing that fosters the national spirit.
As the results of each event are announced, the flags of the winning three nations are hoisted to the top of the flagpoles, with the winning nation's flag on the middle pole.
And there you have it, America, the modern Olympics, the games the gods loved, sprung again like Minerva from the head of Zeus, fully equipped for battle. And there have been battles, either within or about the games, in virtually all the meets held since the first in 1896.
The second Olympiad. Paris, 1900.
The American team splits into two camps over the question of Sunday competition. One group competes, while the rest pray for the backsliders.
The third Olympiad. St. Louis, 1904.
A squabble between Chicago and St. Louis for the honor. England and France pointedly refused to send a single contender. Outstanding incident, a competitor in the marathon confesses,
"Yeah, I'm sorry, but after all, only rode halfway in that automobile."
The ninth Olympiad. Amsterdam, 1928.
The French team wants to quit the games the day before they start because...
"We are insulted! The gatekeeper will not let us into the stadium!"
Meanwhile, the Finns had to scale the walls to get in.
The 10th Olympiad. Los Angeles, 1932.
The Argentine team rebels against its captain. The Brazilian team comes into Los Angeles aboard a naval vessel stocked with coffee, which they were expected to sell en route.
"Only 45 of the 69 of us have a dollar to pay the landing tax to get ashore."
The 11th Olympiad.
Seek harbor! Seek harbor! Seek harbor!
Berlin, 1936.
Adolf Hitler, coming into power after the games have been assigned to Berlin, seeks to convert them into an international Nazi rally based upon Nordic supremacy. Is foiled by American Negro Jesse Owens, who walks off with three victories. But we must not overlook the fact, America, that besides shattering national sensibilities at times, the Olympics have seen man shatter records that mark his athletic prowess. Stronger bodies and better health, if nothing else, may make up for all the international acrimony that often surrounds the game.
Yes, take Patton.
He means the late war hero, General George Patton, who as a young lieutenant in the Army won the modern pentathlon in the 1912 Olympic Games.
Patton stood out in the Olympics because of the rapidity he showed in the use of his weapons, as well as for the immediate advantage he took of the weak points of his opponents. What a lot that meant to us later.
Who can deny that the Olympics have been the cause of a great increase in the interest in sport all over the world? The Olympic committees have founded many new sports movements.
To these voices, add that of General Douglas MacArthur, president of the American Olympic Committee for the 1928 Games.
The Olympic Athletic Code embraces the highest moral laws and will stand the test of any ethics or philosophies ever promulgated for the uplift of man.
Yes, those are some of the opinions on the Olympics. More to the present point is, what do you think? To find out, we called upon our friend George Gallup and the American Institute of Public Opinion. And they, in turn, asked you,
how much do you yourself think the Olympic Games do in building up international goodwill? A lot, a little, or none?
18% of you answered,
well, a little.
24% of you said,
a fair amount.
38% of you felt,
well, the Olympics do a lot to promote good feelings between nations.
And only 15% of you said,
I don't think they help at all.
This, then, is what many of you seem to conclude. That in spite of its many obvious faults, the Olympics still have many good things to recommend them. They are, in short, a good idea. Their principles clear and shining. The troubles that beset them are caused by human nature.
Human nature. It causes newspapers to hail one nation as the winner when the games were founded to honor individual winners. Sports leaders to fight to get their games in the program. Cities to squabble over the honor of holding the games. Nations to charge each other with favoritism.
Yet, if we give up the Olympics, America, we are giving up just one more symbol of the hope of eventual peace and world unity. Baron de Coubertin realized that a better world could only be brought about by better individuals and left us this stirring thought to see us through not only the 14th Olympiad we greet today, but the next Olympiad at Helsinki in 1952 and all the Olympiads to come. As the runners bearing the Olympic torch from Greece to London stopped in Lausanne at the grave of the Baron de Coubertin, his spirit might have spoken.
The important thing in life is not the victory, but the struggle. The essential thing is not to have conquered, but to have fought well. To spread these precepts is to develop a more valiant, stronger, more scrupulous, and more generous humanity.
Living 1948 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC public affairs staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold, with scripts written by Lou Hazem, technical advice by Jane Tiffany Wagner, music conducted by Milton Katims. The program direction was by Jack Cuney. Your narrator was Nelson Case, and our thanks to Sport Magazine for an assist on our research. We invite you to keep abreast of Living 1948 by joining us next week when we'll present a drama document entitled
Atomic Energy is Your Business.
Robert Warren speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.